Welcome to episode 7 of the Piano Fortissimo podcast. I'm Alexandra Silocha, and today I'm thrilled to introduce a very special guest, the renowned Jessica Duchen. This episode is particularly close to my heart as it marks my upcoming debut recital at the National Gallery in London next week on October 10th in honor of 85 years since Myra Hess' legendary wartime concerts. I couldn't think of a more fitting guest to join me in celebrating this milestone than Jessica, who is the author of 3 biographies, Korngold, Fauré, and the London Chamber Orchestra, and is currently working on the book called Myra Hess, National Treasure, which will be published next spring by Cannes and Averill. It is the first biography of Myra Hess to be published since 1976, and contains material from letters and diaries that has never been published before. Welcome to Piano Fortissimo, the podcast where the world of classical music meets personal stories and professional insights. I'm your host, Alexandra Silocha, concert pianist and Bösendorfer artist for over 2 decades. Join me as we explore the intricacies of music careers, the artistry behind pianos and other instruments, dive deep with special guests from all corners of the arts, and uncover the nuances of cultural and self-management. Whether you're an aspiring musician, a performer, or simply a music lover, this podcast offers something for everyone. When the Second World War erupted, the government shut down London's cultural institutions, including music halls, theatres, galleries and museums, to prevent mass casualties in the event of air raids. The National Gallery, located in central London, was particularly at risk and also closed its doors. Most of its artwork was transported to secure locations outside the city. This left Londoners deprived of cultural activities, and it was during this period that the renowned pianist Myra Hess conceived a bold idea to transform the empty gallery into a space of classical music concerts. Hess approached the director of the National Gallery, who warmly embraced the idea, and with Clark's support, the necessary approvals were quickly obtained from the wartime government, and the gallery was swiftly adapted to host music performances. Hess, along with her colleagues from the classical music community, organized concerts throughout the entirety of the war. Starting in October 1939, on the 10th to be precise, these events took place every weekday, year-round, even continuing during the relentless bombing of the Blitz. Hess's vision was to make classical music accessible to everyone, and the concerts proved immensely popular. Long lines of eager listeners would form outside the gallery in Trafalgar Square. Her initiative not only lifted the spirits of ordinary Londoners during a period of severe cultural deprivation, but also attracted a total audience of 750,000 people over 6.5 years. On October 10th, we're celebrating 85 years since her first concert at the National Gallery, and I'm delighted, honored, and slightly nervous to be the pianist chosen for this special event. Join Jessica Duchen and me as we delve into the life and legacy of this extraordinary musician. Jessica, thank you so much for joining the conversation. It's a pleasure and honor to have you here. Your newest book, Myra Hess, National Treasure, will be published next spring by Cannes and Averill, and it is the first biography of Myra Hess to be published since 1976 and contains material from letters and diaries that has never been published before. So my first natural question is, what made you want to write a new biography about Myra Hess?
Well, first, there's the obvious fact that she was a national heroine during World War II with her National Gallery concerts, which played an essential role in keeping up Londoners' morale through the duration of the war. And I became very aware that there are no books about her currently in print. The only people I meet who haven't heard of her are those who've been born in the 21st century. And on the older side, everyone knew who she was and what she did. So I want to help honour her memory and keep it alive. But also, I feel there's almost a personal connection because Myra was very much part of my early memories, not in person, because she died a couple of weeks before I was born. But I grew up in North London, very close to where she had lived. And when I was very small, my mother used to take me for walks on the part of Hampstead Heath known as the Heath Extension. And she would always want to park the car outside number 48 Wildwood Road, which was where Myra Hess had lived. And there was a blue plaque to her. It so happened that my mother's name was also Myra. So that added a certain fascination for me. And then, as I was growing up as a musical kid, I started listening to her recordings, absolutely adored them. More and more became available on CD when I was a student. I used to lap up all those newly remastered historical recordings, and hers were really my favourites. I also shared her Jewish background, rather sort of, formally Orthodox but lapsed. And I used to walk every day past the house of Tobias Matte, her teacher, who lived three streets away from us in Hampstead. And I used to go to the National Gallery a lot with my mum, who was a devotee. So Myra has been part of my life for a long time. And having found the one existing biography of her, which is out of print, really rather frustrating, I've always dreamed of writing another one.
What interesting connections and how life plays. And I feel like it came only natural for you. We both know who was Myra Hess, and but maybe for an international audience, what role did Myra Hess play in promoting classical music to a wider audience, and especially during difficult times like World War II?
Well, the fact is that she was a very well-established pianist already by the time World War II came along. But that's really the thing that has secured her lasting legacy, I would say. Otherwise, she would be another great Golden Age pianist. And being a woman, she might well have been slightly forgotten by a piano establishment that is really quite male biased, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong, but that's how it often strikes me. She effectively became a national treasure, very widely recognized through those concerts in the National Gallery. At the beginning of World War II, well, on the declaration of war, she closed her piano. She expected for the duration of the war that, at that point, she anticipated that for the duration of the war, music would not be the most important thing she could do. And she was going to volunteer as an air raid warden and she was going to help evacuate children to the countryside. She actually did a fair bit of that. But then, within a week or two, there was a lot of talk around her and generally in Britain about how essential culture and music was for keeping up morale at such times. One of the first things that happened was that all cultural life in London closed down, and no one was quite sure what was going on or when it was going to come back. Myra realized that she could play a role in this, and after discussing it with her friends and a fellow pianist, Denise Lassimon, they went to see Sir Kenneth Clarke at the National Gallery. He was the director of the National Gallery, and he'd had to send all the paintings out of London for safety. So he was wandering around in this empty gallery, feeling thoroughly depressed by it. So when Myra and Denise arrived and said, "How about a weekly lunchtime concert in the gallery?" he said, "Well, what about one every day?" In short, Myra, aided and abetted by her friend and right-hand man, Howard Ferguson, who was a neighbour in the same street, she ended up running lunchtime concerts in the National Gallery every weekday, right through World War II, including right through the Blitz, and for a year after the war as well. So they ran every day for 6.5 years. She was then featured in this role in some marvelous propaganda films that were made by the film director Humphrey Jennings. And somehow he portrayed her and her concerts as part of the national oral landscape, part of the national fabric of resistance during World War II. She was also given a damehood for her efforts, and somehow she acquired this image in Britain as the next best thing to the Queen Mother, who incidentally used to attend the National Gallery concerts and was shown in the gallery listening to music in those Humphrey Jennings films. She also invited Myra to perform at Buckingham Palace. So this was really how the whole mythology around Myra took hold.
What do you think we can learn from her resilience during that period?
I reckon that we can learn the role of music in the human spirit from her. I think that those concerts made it palpably obvious that people need music and that it is essential to supporting us as human beings. We need music to support our souls, and especially in terrible times when it really can bring, I don't know, solace, or it's more than escapism. It's something beautiful amid the horror, but it's more than that as well. It props us up. It keeps us believing in better things and better times. And those concerts couldn't have demonstrated that more clearly with the massive audiences that they got. It became a reason why the Arts Council was funded, because Myra had demonstrated physically that the arts are a public good and should and could belong to everybody. It wasn't escapism, it was a weaponized reality. She weaponized the reality that art is part of our essential being and that you mess with that at your peril. So I think we can learn that from Myra Hess.
That's so beautiful. Was known for her humility despite her immense talent. How do you think her character influenced her career and also public perception?
I think part of her attitude of humility and tremendous self-discipline came actually rather strongly from her family Orthodox Jewish background. I think that really instilled in her a sense of discipline and her work ethic as well, which incidentally was quite close to that of her very driven, rather creative father, who came a terrible cropper as a businessman and went bankrupt at one point, and she did not get along with him. But she did actually rather resemble him at times, because he had this intense, driven work ethic, and that pervaded her career as well. And that helped to create the public perception of her as a rather austere, somewhat perhaps rather matronly figure, although she was neither austere nor particularly matronly in person. She had a very naughty sense of humor, and she adored good food and good company and cigarettes. And in her youth, she was quite a party animal. So I think, in a way, the public perception of her as this kind of high priestess of the piano is perhaps. It is inspired by that artistic humility that she had, but it's also a little bit misleading. I think she was a much more sort of sparkly person than people think she would have been. And
I
apparently she
think
had a very rumbustious sense of humour.
must have been fun being around her, I think.
I think so, yes.
How do you think Myra's contributions to the classical music world influenced the role of female pianists in her time and maybe also even today?
Oh, well, I think she set an incredible example. As it happens, there were actually quite a lot of female pianists around at the time. For instance, Myra was a student of Tobias Matthay, and his class at the Royal Academy of Music was very female heavy. So at various times of her life, Myra would have been in contact with a lot of other female pianists, like her friend Irene Schara, her enemy Harriet Cohen, and figures like Wanda Landowska, Gina Bachauer, Moira Limpani, Ilona Karbosch, things like that. I think that, like Landowska, Myra was seen as that kind of high priestess that we just mentioned. And somehow people do rather love to think of women pianists being married to their art. In Myra's case, she really was. The thing is, if you were not, if you married an actual human being who happened to be a man, the chances were in those days that he would expect you to stop working, have children, and stay at home. No way was Myra Hess going to do that. Now, it was a sacrifice to not have a personal life, and she often admitted this, and she often told her pupils this. But I don't think she ever really considered not sticking to her guns and not pursuing a career ahead of anything else. Nowadays, everything is rather different. I think that there are some female pianists who appear to be sold to the public on their looks as much as their playing. Myra would have given that very short shrift. And indeed, it was happening in her day, notably with Harriet Cohen. Myra was quite a beauty in her youth, and it didn't hurt. When she was becoming established in the States, everyone was going, "Oh, she looks nice." You know, she was described in some reviews as having a very comely figure. But later on, she became deliberately self-effacing so as not to detract from the audience's focus on listening and on the music that she was playing. But even here, there are some slightly misleading myths about her, like the idea she only ever wore black on stage. She sometimes wore red velvet.
Interesting. Can because you know so much and you're so close to Myra, can you share some interesting stories or anecdotes from her life that might reveal more about her personality, maybe off stage?
Right, how long have you got? I've just jotted down here a few stories that I think could illuminate different sides of her. The first is the time she met Rachmaninoff. This is a story that Stephen Kovacevic has told. He was her star pupil. But in New York in the early 1920s, she not only played Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, she played it to Rachmaninoff himself, and actually with him, because he accompanied her playing the orchestral part on a second piano. The day before that meeting, she suddenly remembered that in the performances she had done, there was habitually a cut of several pages. And she hadn't learnt those pages that were, normally it was just the done thing to cut them. So she was afraid that Rachmaninoff would be offended by this, and she thought she'd better learn them PDQ. And she stayed up all night practicing those extra pages so that she could include them. So that was an insight into her conscience and her sense of responsibility and her work ethic. As it
I'm
turned out,
so
at the meeting, she said he didn't say much to her, but she could tell he was pleased. But then she went to a concert of his, and he played Schumann's Carnival, and he had learned in a wrong note, which she spotted. And she went backstage and she told him. And nobody would have dared to do that, but she did. She would always speak up when there was an issue, whether it was telling Rachmaninoff he was playing a wrong note or telling Irene Shara that her dress was on back to front or whatever, it would be Myra who would go and do the deed. So how did Rachmaninoff respond? Well, he sent her the biggest bouquet of flowers she had ever received.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So do you want some more?
Yes,
Yeah.
please.
Well, she had a very quick, sharp wit. And once in the late 1930s, about 1938, I think, an interviewer asked her why there were not more women pianists. So Myra riposts to this: "There are not more women pianists because most women are too sensible to wish to spend their lives on trains." Yeah, she was quite a joker. She had a really filthy sense of humour. And Howard Ferguson once said that he was in the RAF musical section of the band in World War II. He once said that they used to joke that the source of all their filthy jokes was Myra Hess. And the violinist Yeli Dorani, who was her duo partner for 20 years or more, had a nickname for her, which was Piskos, which is Hungarian for dirty. Unfortunately, it's been quite hard to find written examples of these jokes because I think they must always have been deemed unprincipled. So I haven't got as many of them in the book as I would like.
She seems always ready to speak the right words.
Yeah, she would always, I think, say the right thing and also do the right thing. And she was extremely generous. She played a lot with the Griller String Quartet, for instance. They were a leading British ensemble to a considerably younger than her, and they performed a lot in the National Gallery, but they were very hard up because it was very difficult for a string quartet to make a living, that the concert fee would be divided in four, and they really struggled. So in World War II, it turns out that when her American friends had all clubbed together to create a Myra Hess fund to help keep the National Gallery concerts going, she wrote then to Sidney Griller and she sent him some money. And she said something like, "Now I have my own fund and I can do what I like with it. What better thing could I do than help you?"
She has helped a lot of musicians and also, yeah, Jewish musicians during this time.
Yes, those concerts played a very important role in helping a lot of refugee Jewish musicians become established in Britain. There's something like two dozen of them who performed at those concerts, and it gave them a platform. It gave them a little bit of, there was a flat fee for everyone who was playing in the concerts, which wasn't a lot, but it was better than nothing. And it helped them to make contacts and become known and to really get to grips with living here and to start having careers here. So she played a crucial role in that.
In terms of repertoire, in what ways did Myra's choice reflect her personal artistic vision? Do you think there are pieces she performed that she felt especially connected to, or how did she choose this huge repertoire for all these concerts at the National Gallery? Do you know more about this?
Yes, the National Gallery concerts repertoire, I think she and Howard, Howard Ferguson, the composer, was playing a very important role in this too. So they discussed everything and they planned everything together. It wasn't so much a question of them deciding, right, we're going to have this piece, and that piece. It was more a question that people were coming to them with concert programs that they wished to perform. And what Myra and Howard had to do was to ensure that it wasn't the same pieces being played all the time. So a lot of pianists would come along offering the same few Beethoven sonatas, and Myra didn't want it to be all the Appassionata and the Waldstein and Opus 111. So she encouraged people to play different things. You need that variety for audiences coming along day after day. And because of that, they developed the idea of big series. So they had all Beethoven's piano music and all Beethoven's string quartets and all Mozart's piano concertos. And they built up these sort of complete series that would run through the concerts.
But is if sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just thinking, in terms of, I mean, I don't know of any other pianist doing this job. I mean, she was actually more than a concert pianist. She was a manager, she was a programmer, she was a curator. I'm not aware of somebody else doing this in these times, or even, I mean, up until these days, where we're used to do so many things at the same time, but for that time, this was quite extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely. It was very, very unusual. But I think that the beginning of World War II in the musical field was, it was a bit like the beginning of the COVID pandemic,
Yes.
that it was the Wild West. No one knew what was going on. No one knew what to do. Everyone knew they had to do something. And things were made possible that would not have been made possible at any other time. So, for instance, there were all kinds of rules and regulations that those concerts probably should have complied with that they didn't comply with because no one knew what was going to happen. Everyone that there were regulations about not having more than 200 people in the space at any one time. And they never thought that was going to be a problem. And then 1,000 people turned up for the first concert. And you know, what do? You've got this, you've got a queue of 1,000 people going around Trafalgar Square. So things were being done that would never have been done at any other point. And yeah, I don't know of any other musicians who, I think there were some in America who ran series, but they were on a much smaller scale. They certainly weren't every day, and they certainly were not put on despite bombs falling all around.
Are there any references about how she was connecting to the audience before the concert?
I don't know if this was something that kind of happened habitually or if it was just an occasional thing, and I don't really know what she would have been saying. I think there were certain times when she made a little speech to thank somebody or to point out that someone had been travelling all night in order to be there. Those kinds of things. I don't think she did a huge amount of it, but I think she was perfectly capable of getting up and saying a couple of words when occasion demanded.
I also know that I mean she was known for her incredible discipline and preparation, and I read that some concertos were prepared in just a couple of days, and I was wondering, are there any insights you have gathered about her, maybe about her practice routines?
Yes, I mean, I think the question of playing things at a couple of days' notice, I think that was probably supported by her decision to stop playing from memory. So she would have used the music for those, and she would have had a page turner. But for in terms of practice routine, she believed in slow practice. It was always slow practice, especially right before a concert. And there was a wonderful story actually that she was once staying in Yale with a friend of hers, another fellow ex-Mate pupil who had become dean of the music school there. And she was staying in his house and she was preparing for a recital, practicing the Brahms Handel variations. So her friend went out one day just as she was beginning slow practice on the theme, and he was out for 2 hours. And when he came back, she had just reached the fugue. So kind of go figure, really.
Given the challenges faced by female musicians in Hess era, and not only, how do you think she navigated the classical music world, and what strategies did she employ to build such a successful, respected career despite these barriers?
Well, the first thing, obviously, is that she stayed single. She apparently turned down three proposals of marriage, all of them around 1910. And I honestly think that she did sacrifice her personal life in order to focus entirely on her music. She had a lot of friends, but as far as I know, she just avoided emotional involvement after a couple of early romances that went horribly wrong for one reason or another, which is another story. But she was a sociable person and she didn't like being alone. So she built structures around her to help herself through it, really. She had a PA who I think made it all possible for her. She did everything. This PA was called Anita Gunn and she was nicknamed Saz. She was the daughter of a friend of Myra's mother, and her sister Marjorie was also a very close friend of Myra's. So Saz joined her for the American tour in 1931, and she stayed on as general kind of woman Friday for the rest of Myra's life. So I think that was an enormous support for Myra because she had someone there who could do the poached eggs and who could mend the concert gowns and who could help organize everything and keep the, you know, she could do the bookkeeping, she could do the booking of hotels and trains and all of that. And Myra could just concentrate on the music. So I think that wherever she was, whether she was in Britain or in the States, because she would spend 3 or 4 months every year in the States, she would have a sort of entourage around her. There was a very close inner circle in London, certainly, in which Howard Ferguson was a very important figure. He was really her right-hand man for the duration of the concerts. There was her niece Beryl, who served as secretary for the concerts and often travelled with her and Sass to the States. And actually, Myra was very good at schmoozing. She was her American agent was very pleased that she was happy to go and have tea with the sponsors everywhere. And she would make friends with people like the Steinway family in the States and indeed the Queen Mother in London. And along with this, I think her sense of humour really helped her. This was something she and Saz definitely shared. I think they had quite a lot of fun together with their very, very sharp, observant wits. And another great friend of Myra's was the comedian Joyce Grenfell, who was an extraordinary comic talent who, again, probably needs some more books to herself. But during the 1950s, the two of them found themselves on the same ship to the States, and Joyce had some new comic songs to try out. So Myra accompanied her while she sang them, which is rather lovely. But in terms of what she did to kind of support herself, she also stopping playing from memory was quite important after the war. I think it was something that happened to her during the war because she was playing such a huge volume of music and there was so much stuff to get through. There just was not time to do the memorization. So playing with the music was quite controversial at the time. But by that stage of her career, Myra was big enough not really to care much about what people said. And even if she did mind critics assuming she was doing it because she was insecure, she wasn't insecure. She just ignored them, really. And she had a series of page turners who were mostly very nice young men. And I think she rather enjoyed that. And this was, in fact, how she met some of the youngsters who then came to Britain to study with her.
Well, this brings me to the next question, actually, because you also mentioned Stephen Kovacevic. Do we know who her pupils were, or how she was as a teacher, or is there anything we might be able to know about this?
Well, there's a large chapter in the book devoted to my interviews with some of her ex-pupils, who they're the ones who are still with us. By the time, I mean, she used to teach a lot at the very beginning of her career, funnily enough, because she needed to earn a living before she really became established and started going to the States. So she had a lot of pupils then, and she was an experienced teacher and enjoyed it very much. But then there wasn't time for her really to teach while she was travelling the world. In the late 1950s, her health was suffering very badly. And around 1960 or thereabouts, she cut down the amount of concerts she was doing. And from 1961, her health was really very badly affected. So she spent much more time at home in London, and she had many more pupils. She wasn't well enough to have a great many pupils, but she was very fond of the ones she did have. So Stephen Kovacevic was much the best known. Jonty Solomon was another one. He came from South Africa to study with her. And there were two twins in America, Richard and John Contiguglia, who I've talked to at some length, that they absolutely adored and revered Myra, and they hold for they're the only people I interviewed who always called her Dame Myra whenever I talk to them. There was a lady called Anne Shine, who is very much in the piano world in East Coast of the States. I think she lives somewhere north of Boston, and she was absolutely lovely at described her studies with Myra at some length. And there were quite a few other people who would play to her, not as formal pupils, but as kind of consultations, people like Dennis Matthews, for example, and someone else who Malcolm Frazer was another one. Then there was Clive Lithgow, who was a very interesting figure. Sadly, I never was able to interview him. He died quite a while ago. But he had a big career, which he then stopped because he suffered so badly from nerves. And he devoted himself instead to music in underprivileged communities in the States and set up what we would now regard as kind of outreach education projects in some fairly deprived areas in America. Which was a really pioneering thing to do in those days. So he was very significant. There were quite a few people who really benefited from her mentorship, whether as students or just as consultation situations. And I think she was a very demanding teacher, from what I've gathered. I mean, the Contiguglias said that they arrived with master's degrees from Yale University, and they had never worked so hard in their lives as when they realized how hard Myra needed them to work.
Tough lady.
Yep, she was tough, and she could, she didn't mince her words. She, as Stephen Kovacevic put it, she was not the girl next door. She was, I think that there was a recorded interview with Yonti Solomon, where he describes that quite a destructive effect of some of the things that she said to him at times. Although in the end he was very devoted and very fond of her. I think there were some ups and downs along the way. So she was no picnic, but gosh, they learned a lot from her.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica. I cannot wait for your new biography book to be published.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights and passion for Myra Hess's extraordinary life and music. It's been an inspiring conversation, shedding light on not only her artistic genius, but also her resilience and legacy. For our listeners, if you'd like to explore more of Jessica's work, make sure to check out her website. I'm going to link it in the description. And as soon as the book is going to be published, I'll make sure to let you know on all social media channels.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me on this very special episode of the Piano Fortissimo podcast. It's been a privilege to explore Myra Hess' extraordinary legacy with Jessica Duchen, and I hope it has brought you a deeper understanding of how one pianist's vision made such an enduring impact on the cultural life of wartime London. As we celebrate 85 years since those historic concerts, I feel truly honored to step into this tradition next week at the National Gallery, and I hope to carry forward the spirit of music as a source of hope and unity, just as Myra Hess did so many years ago. Stay tuned for more episodes, and don't forget to follow the Piano Fortissimo podcast on Instagram or Facebook, on Apple Podcasts and Spotify for more stories, insights, and conversations with leading figures in the world of classical music. Thank you, see you next time, and don't forget, worry less and let the music flow. Thanks for listening. This was Alexandra Silocha from Piano Fortissimo. Don't forget to subscribe, share with fellow music enthusiasts, follow us on your favorite social media, and most importantly, worry less and let the music flow.